This station is conducting a test of the emergency broadcast system. This is only a test.
Look, before we start this episode of the James McMahon Music Podcast, I need to tell you something. I need your help. I need you, when you finish with the episode, to go to the platform you've listened to this podcast on and give me a rating, a review, and to subscribe too. It helps me cheat the algorithm and get more ears on the podcast. And know this, I'm very grateful for it. Also, I have a Substack where I write about music and film and telly and all sorts of stuff. I love it if you sign up for Dispatches. There are different price options, £5 a month, £50 a year, and for that, you get access to loads of exclusive writing and podcasts. It's the most helpful thing you can do to support the stuff I make. And again, I'd be so grateful. That's spook.substack.com. That's spook with three O's. Thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you.
I thank Jesus.
This concludes this test of the emergency broadcast system.
You're listening to the James McMahon Music Podcast, and I'm your host, James McMahon, and this is a Spook Media production.
Oh, we enjoy ourselves.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun. But
it's
when you start to explain why that it becomes difficult. I mean, recording's fun and just, you know, being together and playing, all those things are fun. But I mean, they're serious as well.
The Autumn's Beach House, the Deers, fucking love the Deers. Dirty Three, Emmy the Great, Theon Reagan, Howlin' Bells, John Grant, Lanterns on the Lake, Laura Beers, Lift to Experience, Midlake, The Walkman. For the last 25 years, Bella Union have been responsible for bringing me some of the best music that I've ever heard. And before that, the label's owner, Simon Raymond, in tandem with Elizabeth Frazier and Robert Guthrie and the immortal Cocteau Twins, was responsible for bringing me even more. I can't imagine what my listening habits would look like without Simon and without Bella Union. And so I'm delighted to speak to him on this episode about all of the above and more. On this episode, we talk about the band Simon is currently managing, the brilliant Big Joni, how Bella Union came to be, his thoughts on the legacy of his old band, the Cocteau Twins, his feelings on where the record business finds itself in 2023, his forthcoming memoir, and his posthumous relationship with his father, the late, great Ivor Raymond. How great? I mean, he wrote the Dusty Springfield song, I Only Want to Be With You, so that's pretty fucking great. You join myself and Simon as we're talking about navigating the dark and dreary days of January. Stick with us. It's a corker, this one. I like how you're wearing some of your own merch today, Simon.
Yeah, it's the only clean thing I had in the house. Freebies.
Reminds me a little bit of my days in a band when I would wear our own merch because, yeah, like you say, you know, I mean, it was either rock or do the laundry. And I know
it's exactly
been
a
lot of fun, you know. So.
Exactly. The washing machine is on as we speak.
Good to know. Good breaking that news with the listeners of this podcast. Listen, it's such a treat to speak to you. I've always loved your label for God as long as I remember.
It's been a while.
Back I was. I know, it's crazy, man. But back in my NME days, you know, Duncan Jordan, the hardest working man in showbiz, used to, you know, fill my life with amazing music. So, and I've sort of followed it. sort of followed it from that point on. And I guess that, you know, do you still feel like a little bit like we're in the sort of 25th year? Do you still feel like those sort of celebrations are going on, so to speak?
You know what? I don't. I really feel like we're in the dark ages, actually. It's I don't know whether it's just the sort of the winter misery and the cold and the darkness. I just feel like we haven't really come out of the other side yet. So the last year just feels like a million miles away. I'm trying to get into the kind of new year spirit, embrace the new and like look forward, but I'm still half my foot is still in, you know, feeling a bit like, oh God, this all over again, which I'm sure I'll come out of it shortly. It's inevitable.
Well, do you mean personally or do you mean in terms of work?
Well, the kind of thing, the two things are the same. Yeah. I don't really have a personal life. You know, when you do this, like, because I don't just do the label, I do management stuff as well. You know, I manage quite a lot of bands. And there's, I was talking with my wife about it the other day because she does it with me. And it's kind of all consuming, isn't it? It's, you sort of wake up thinking about it and then, you know, you go to bed talking about it, you know, at 1 o'clock in the morning, thinking about work stuff. So it's hard to sort of disassociate the work and the personal life. And maybe that's part of the problem is I need to be better at, you know, managing me and my time. So I have a bit more of a rounded, balanced life because I definitely haven't for quite a long time.
It's rough, isn't it? Because there have been times in recent years where I've thought I need to think about doing something else, you know, just because of the logistics of how difficult it is to, you know, make a living writing and talking about music now. But at the same time, yeah, it's like you're basically just going, well, I need to be a completely different person. And that's like,
yeah,
harder said than done, you know.
That's it. You know, reinvent yourself is you know, takes it takes a lot of work. But I suppose, you know, I don't know how you dealt with COVID, good or bad. But, you know, I definitely found some of that isolation and time to spend on yourself actually quite liberating. And you know, did learn quite a bit about myself that I hadn't really noticed before. So I'd like to get back to that because I feel like I've lost that in the last, you know, 9 months since things have been a bit more, well, I'd hardly say normal. I don't think they'll ever be normal again, but like a bit back to how they were prior to the pandemic. Because I've lost whatever it was I gained during the pandemic in terms of sort of self, I don't know, care.
Well, what do you feel like you learned about yourself in that time, though?
That I needed to look after myself a lot better than I had been doing for the past 20-odd years. You know, fitness, health, food, sleep, work-life balance, all that bullshit that, you know, you think you're on top of, but you barely, rarely are. And I think because we couldn't go anywhere and there wasn't really anything to do, I had two kind of crucial things going on in my life. I was making a record for the first time in a long while, Lost Horizons thing, and that focused me very deeply and sharply on my music, which is a wonderful thing. But at the same time, spending so much time dedicated to that meant that I, you know, was just basically sitting in a chair from morning till bedtime, which is just not a healthy thing to be doing.
Yeah.
Mixing the record and stuff. So once I sort of worked that out and decided that I needed to, you know, I needed to get fit, I needed to lose weight, I needed to get my brain and my body into shape, because otherwise, you know, I'll be looking at an early grave if I carry on like this. And that was sort of my mentality. I wasn't going to go to the gym because I can't stand the gym. Don't like the kind of people that go to gyms, feel uncomfortable and self-conscious in a gym. So I thought, you can't just keep moaning about not going to the gym. You have to do something about it. So I started, you know, sort of self awareness of my body, which was a bit of a revelation, quite weird. But I walked for like, you know, 2 hours every day, not strolling. I mean, actually fast walking. Because I thought, I'm not running. I don't want to play any, I don't want to do weights. I don't want to do any of that. I don't want to spend stupid amounts of money in the gym, but I do need to do something to get my heart pumping. And that's what I did. I did it for best part of a year, and I lost something like 70 pounds. I wasn't really eating like dramatically different, but I definitely was doing, you know, 2 hours fast walking every morning. This is before most people are even thinking about getting up.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really wasting the day away, like, you know, being self-indulgent on my health. I was just getting up earlier and maybe going to bed earlier. And I actually liked it enormously. But I've lost all of that in the last 9 months. I haven't done any of it. But there are reasons why, but they're just excuses rather than good reasons.
They are and they aren't, though. I mean, I've spoken about this on the podcast before, but, you know, during the, I was struggling with a bunch of stuff kind of before the pandemic. It's been a bit of it's been an insane 5 years for me, but during the pandemic, there were so many things that kind of just, almost like sort of like societal obligations that fell away, and therefore it exposed some problems myself. And one of them was sleep. I ended up getting hospitalised because I just lost the ability to sleep.
Oh,
and, the other one was food, you know, and I realised that I had a real problem with binging, basically, which was, you know, linked to unhappiness and all that sort of stuff. But
yeah.
The woman who I speak to now, the therapist, she says just how many people have been in touch with their organisation about overeating, because almost like the pandemic just exposed it, really, you know. Yeah. So I think we're all, the world's just a big throbbing mess of misery and anger and trauma right now, you know.
It really is. It really is. And that's why I haven't really come out the other side yet. You know, last year was a lot of celebrations, a lot of parties, a lot of, well, I don't drink or take drugs, so parties in the sense of, you know, yeah, celebrating music. But, you know, it was a lot of that, coming together and seeing people and enjoying that. And I sort of stopped around about the, you know, 10th of December, and I'm not back in the swing of things yet. I will be. I'm not somebody that dwells on things or sort of festers away. I don't let it get to me too much in general. So I will find a way out of it. And that will probably mean getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and going for a nice long walk, because that's what seems to work for me. It's just sometimes I don't really feel like doing it because it's so fucking cold outside.
It's funny, you know, I interviewed your man, John Grant, for The Observer a couple of years ago, and we were having this massive conversation about, like, mental health and stuff, and he was saying, as like, infuriating as it is for him to hear or to realise that this is true, when he thinks about being a kid and being unhappy and his mum saying, we've got to get outside and you've got to have some routine and you've got to have some order and all these things that he dismissed as, oh, mum, you know, actually there's a lot to be said for it, you know, like, yeah, actually routine and following schedules and having targets and stuff, you know. I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, we got out of the caves in the first place.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that's why my year of walking along the cliff, walking along the coast here in Brighton every morning for 2 hours, you know, I couldn't see myself doing that a few years ago. So the fact that I did it and I know that it worked is reason enough why I need to return to it. Because, like John said to you, you know, it doesn't seem like a fun idea when you're cozy inside the duvet and, you know, you've shutting the whole thing out. But get up and do it, and, you know, you'll gain the benefit of it later. I see all these people in the sea. That's the other insane thing. People around here in Brighton, no matter what the weather, you know, tomorrow morning, if I went out in the sub-zero temperatures, there will be somebody in the sea swimming. And I find that to be a bridge too far. I'm not going down that road. But I could do the walk.
Yeah. Do the
walk. Walk past. Wave. Morning.
Do you listen to music or podcasts or anything when you do it?
Not music. No, I what I find with when I'm out at that time is that's my break from music. So I tend not to listen to music. I tend to listen to podcasts or audiobooks.
Right.
You know, I did quite, and I do languages. I've started Duolingo some of those works, trying to get my Italian up to speed.
Does music still, does it still make you feel like it used to?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm still obsessed about it, you know, unhealthily so. That there's no doubt about it. It is an unhealthy obsession, an addiction possibly. But I think, you know, in the same way that we've been talking about, like, the mental health side of things, I do believe that that music saves me. I do. It keeps me sane. It is my therapy. No, there's no doubt about that. I'd rather listen to, you know, an album than go and talk to a counsellor. That's just how I feel about it. It really does help me get through the day. Heals. You know, it infuriates, of course, as well in a business sense when things don't go the way you want them to, or the, you know, issues come up that are massively annoying. But strip all of that stuff away. Music itself, the actual art of listening, is something that I can't do without. And I keep waking up thinking, is today the day where I'm not excited about pressing play on a SoundCloud link that somebody just sent me? You know, and I'm expecting that day to come, because there must be a point where I'm like, I just don't care anymore. But I haven't. It hasn't so far.
Could you see Bellini existing for another 25 years?
25 years from now. So I'm 60 this year. Yeah, I mean, I guess so. Let me think. I mean, what's rough trade? That must be... Jeff Travis must be 70. My best, Daniel Miller, Mute, must be 70.
Yeah.
Maybe he's 10 years older than me. Maybe. I don't know. They all seem healthy and fit and happy doing it. So maybe another 10 years. 25 is probably pushing it.
Do you still... Well, I guess it's kind of like going back. I mean, I didn't really want to do a sort of chronological thing because, I don't know, I sometimes think that, like, the present day is more interesting than the past in lots of ways. But when you started the label, just give us a little recap of, like, why you started Belly Union and what you can remember about the beginning.
I mean, it is going back.
So it's 97, so right?
97, yeah. So the band literally heard... We just finished a record. We just put out our last record, Milk and Kisses. This is Cocteau Twins, and we had a studio where we, you know, we're recording all our records in by the river in Richmond, and you know, seemingly everything going for us. But the band was sort of in a funny place. The other two members of the group had previously been a couple, and now weren't a couple anymore. But we'd sort of found this balance where we were all, you know, still 100% committed to it. But then I think Elizabeth just felt that she wasn't enjoying it as much anymore and was finding it a struggle. And she called just to say she couldn't do it anymore. Now, previous to this, maybe go back 6 months, we decided to start up a label to put out the next Cocteau Twins record and any related solo collaborative things we wanted to do. Because we'd been on two labels previous that hadn't really gone that well, so we thought we should do it ourselves, and then we don't have to talk to anyone, just put our own records, easy. So then without the band, now the band breaks up, we've started this label, we've got a letterhead, we've got a logo, got a studio, we've got staff. What the hell are we going to do now? So I think the immediate panic was, we've got to do something, because we've got a rent to pay, and you know, if we don't have a band anymore, then how are we going to survive? So we signed a couple of bands, signed the Dirty Three, and we signed John Grant's band, The Czars, and those were the first two signings to the label, and that's how it began. Well, actually, the first record on Bellini was my solo record, which I'd sort of previously been making while I was in the studio fiddling around waiting for Robin and Liz to kind of get stuff together. So that was the first release. And I have to say, I probably didn't assume we would get much past those first three releases. You know, put these out, see how it goes. But, you know, we don't know the first thing about running a record label. So more than likely, it'll all be over within a few, you know, a few months. But here we are, still here.
I mean, you mentioned Rough Trade and Mute. Like, did you get anything in the way of advice or help in terms of establishing Belly Union?
No, but I think that's probably more because we didn't ask for it. You know, I don't think we were just a very anti-social band. We weren't like particularly friendly with other bands or people in the business. We were just a bit of an island, you know, out on our own, doing our own thing, really very chatty with people. Had some mates in bands, but for the most part, we weren't really participating in the music business. We were kind of sidestepping it. So much as I admired all those people from afar, you know, in time, at the time of our creation, I probably was too proud to ask for help or didn't really know who or how to ask. So just sort of stumbled through, really, like everything I've ever done, just sort of like make loads of mistakes, work out what not to do, and then you'll find out what to do as a result, you know, of your own failings. And I think that's how it went. Just make loads of mistakes and thought, oh, I better not do that again. Let's try this. And keep trying until something worked. I'm stubborn, man. I'm just so stubborn. That's probably why we're still here.
It's funny. I did an episode last Friday with the guy who's written some bizarre book, and Wesley Doyle. And, you know, we started talking about sort of people who'd given their whole life to music, you know, and sort of had a vision for what music should be or could be even. And stubbornness was definitely a major theme, I think, you know.
I think it's genetic with me, possibly. my dad was the same. And, you know, I've obviously learned a lot, not from him as a person, because I hardly knew him. He died so young, but I follow, you know, I've obviously learned a lot and followed his career. And I know that stubbornness was a huge part of his career.
You're saying you didn't really know your dad, but if he hadn't been a musician and touched the things that he touched, do you think that your life would have been different if that hadn't been the case with your dad?
That's a good question. I have asked myself that before, but I don't know the answer fully, because my own sort of investigation into the depth of his career, actually what he really achieved other than the headline things, which I, of course, knew growing up, like, you know, Dusty Springfield, the Walker Brothers, David Bowie. I knew those small things, or huge things. I knew the big things, but I didn't know all the sort of granular detail of what he did.
Right.
And probably having a label has allowed me the sort of, what's the word, indulge me. I've given myself the indulgence to put out music of his. No one else was going to do that. No one else was going to release two double albums of Ivor Raymond's music. But I was able to because I have my own label, which I like that. But it also allowed me to get a lot closer to him as a result of it. Because, you know, he did die young. I was in my 20s. And from 14, when punk happened, through to when he died, I don't remember having a conversation with him about music, really. You know, I was just off doing my own thing, just being a punk kid. And he was in the 80s in the 80s, because he died at the end of the 80s, he wasn't really working. You know, no one was offering him jobs anymore. So we just didn't have that connect that perhaps we would have done in a different time, in a different environment. Obviously, in the 60s and 70s, he was just like insane, working away all the time. Never saw him.
Yeah.
Growing up, I never saw the bloke.
Yeah.
You know, he was always away or in the studio. So my kind of, I don't know whether it's, this is all sort of related, what he did, what I did, because we do similar things in a weird way. He was an A&R man, a producer, a musical director, arranger. I don't really do arranging of stuff particularly, but, you know, I do all the other stuff.
Yeah.
So there is definite correlation between what he did and what I do, but I don't really see it as I'm doing it because he did it.
No, of course, but I mean, it's weird. Like, my dad passed away last summer, and I had quite a complicated relationship with my dad. And thanks, man. But I'm writing a book at the moment, and a lot of it is about my dad. And you're writing it, and you go in, you know, I had a moment where I went, I'm writing this because I loved my dad. You know, it's like you might not kind of realize at the time the sort of that you're following in the footsteps of, or the influence that that person had. But I just think that parents just have such a, you know, for better, for worse, influence on all of us, that it's very hard to kind of shake that and, you know, kind of fly your own trajectory, really, sometimes.
You're right. You know, and I am finding that out, you know, even at my advanced age, I am finding that out. And I've just finished my book, a memoir, and half the book is about my dad, you know, and a lot of it is researched, you know, into his family life, which I just didn't know so much about. And it's really helped me understand him and his relationship with music, and his relationship with my mom and his family and his Jewish and Polish background. You know, it's all like, it's all just starts putting it together. You know, at that point in your life where you start, where you join ancestry.co.uk or whatever it is, and you start kind of like, oh, okay, so she was the grandmother. You know, you start putting it all together and working out who all these people you've heard about in your life are. And this is what my book has sort of enabled me to do, is sort of turn a sort of vague ancestry interest into something that genuinely resonates with me, you know.
When do you think that that will be out?
Well, I submitted it to the publisher about a week ago. So I think he told me it would probably either be the end of this year or early next year. And that apparently takes forever to put a book out. I know I've never done anything like this before, so I'm a bit new to it. But yeah, I'll just follow his lead.
My deadline is in 9 days, and
yeah,
I've obviously chosen to you know, repopulate my podcast rather than actually just get it finished. So you mentioned the Cocteau's before. Do you miss playing in that band?
Do I miss playing in the band? I miss the band. I miss playing. I mean, I miss the studio. I mean, yeah, of course. How could you not? It's an incredible band to have been part of, and every second of it I cherish, even the bad stuff, because, you know, the band continues to, find new fans every day. It never ceases to amaze me how many new people keep coming on, you know, keep getting in contact about this group that I was in for a while. So yeah, I miss it in a sense. I miss it in a sense. But it just does feel like a different life almost.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it is 25 years ago we finished. So I've lived a whole nother life since then. So I said it almost feels like someone else's life, you know?
Well, I think it's also that the music that you made in so many ways just didn't sound like anyone else. It's funny you were saying that thing. I don't know. It's like, not only do I think that's right, that the music you made was sort of so different to anything, which I can imagine you could feel quite, you could almost kind of like put it in a bubble and be like, well, that was then and this is now. But also, you're the only legendary indie band that are never going to reform, aren't you? So that's kind of a wild thing.
Yeah, well, the Smiths, maybe.
Yeah, I still don't know about that. But, you know, obviously there's some ideological issues going on there. But I just think with your band, I mean,
I don't see it. But, you know, you can never say never, never. But I think it's highly unlikely. I mean, we're all 60 now, so we have something pretty miraculous would need to happen. Or something absolutely terrible would need to happen. I don't know how you'd look at it, really. My view on it is it shouldn't happen. But that's my view on it today. Once upon a time, I thought it wouldn't be a bad idea if it did happen. You know, we almost did reform at one point in the early 2000s, I think it was. There was a moment in time where it looked like it might happen. But I'm glad it didn't, and I'm absolutely happy with it, the fact that it didn't, because if we did do it, I can't see that it would be for a particularly good reason.
Without being like too, without being too gross, like the offers that you would have had back then, have they gone up?
Somebody did make an offer. I can't remember who it was. Like one of the big promoters made us an offer last year. Came through John's manager, actually Fiona. I don't think it was that much. I think it was like, yeah, I don't think it wasn't like, it wasn't an earth-shattering amount of money to the point where if you were desperate and completely down on your luck and thought, I just need money to pay this tax bill or, you know, this alimony or whatever it would, yeah. I don't even know if it would excite you that much. But given that money, you know, is just, it's just a terrible reason to do something.
Yeah.
In the world that I live in, you know, because I don't ever have any of it. I don't really, you know, I just about get by, and this living is fine for me. You know, I've had just enough to pay the mortgage, and you know, I've gone on one holiday a year, got a nice car, got my dog, you know, beautiful wife. I'm very happy with what I've got. I don't need anything more. I don't need, you know, a villa in Tuscany. I don't need a second house anywhere. I've just about got enough. This is all fine. So I don't look at it like, but listen, if we reformed, I'd have a great big payday and I could go and get well, what exactly? I don't need for anything. I'm happy. Yeah, happy with what I've got.
I think that's an incredibly healthy attitude to have.
Well, yeah, I hope I always have that, because I think that's when you go down a rocky road where you like get into trouble and you make stupid decisions. You know, and I think in a way, that's what we did with when we left 4AD. We made a stupid decision. We signed to a major label, and we did take a lot of money. Seemed like the right decision at the time, because we were just so, disillusioned by being friends with our business partners. And when that went wrong, we thought, well, fuck it, let's just take money and do what we need to do, make records we want to make, buy a studio, spend the money on our thing, and that'll be cool, won't it? But it obviously wasn't. It didn't work at all, because you know, you take any money off a major label, there's a huge price to pay in what you need to give back.
Yeah, it's definitely meeting at the crossroads, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't just be artsy and like not do anything. You know, they expect you to go and work for your money and do certain stupid things that you would never normally consider to do. But you don't realise that till you sign the deal, and then it's too late. So that was a pretty unhealthy situation to be in for a while. But, you know, that, you live and you learn.
That relationship that you had with a major, how much does that shape the way that you operate Bally Union?
Well, not really. I mean, you know, you just know there are some things that you just shouldn't do. You shouldn't be asking bands to do. I mean, I think you learn more about this business by the things that go wrong than the things that go right. And definitely signing to the major was, in hindsight, wrong. It was the wrong thing to do, but we did it for the right reasons. So I don't regret it. Do you know what I mean? I can say, It made sense for the 10 minutes that we thought about it, for that anonymity of relationship, just to have the money to do what we wanted to do, buy our own gear, buy equipment for the studio, you know, help us make the records that we wanted to make in our own space. That was why we wanted to do that deal. We couldn't have financed it through the independent thing. It did buy us a moment in time where we could invest in our studio. Of course, the relationship went horribly wrong within 10 minutes of signing the deal. But, you know, that of course, that was like, okay, well, we can never have a record label where that is the premise, where it's all about the money. We wouldn't have had, because we never did like an imprint via a major label thing. Plenty of labels did around that period where we're like, let's set up this imprint and we'll put it through Universal. And they give us shed loads of money. But we never did that. We started with zero and built our way slowly up. Well, not really slowly, just barely at all.
How important do you think being Simon Raymond from the Cocteau Twins is in acts coming to Bally Union? And do you ever have any of the newer acts, perhaps, that aren't even aware of that previous life?
Yeah, I think some are not aware of it, and that's absolutely fine by me. And some are. You know, I guess there's going to be people that know what I do, and if they want to research it, and you know, that's all well and good. But hopefully, it's got nothing to do with whether Bally Union is a good label or not. I mean, I'm just a guy like anyone else, just trying to do my thing. And my past and my previous band, it might be a calling card to some. But I don't think it matters in any way. It shouldn't influence anybody's decision to come to the label. I mean, they look at the bands that we've got and say, oh, I'd be happy being alongside those artists. Maybe it gives me a credibility in terms of what I say to the band, a truthfulness and honesty and something authentic. I know what I'm talking about because I've been in a band, kind of thing. You know, as a producer, maybe people are like, well, he's not an idiot. He's been here before. He knows the game. Therefore, I'll take it. You know, I'll take that. So I guess it may influence some people one way or the other, but I don't know. I've never really thought about it, to be honest.
Yeah. Did you? I was sort of very clumsily trying to explain a little bit the kind of how otherworldly that, like, I thought the music of the Cocteau was. So I don't think there really is any music that really sounds like that. But at the same time, with the label, did you have to kind of... how important was it that this wasn't a label that just released dreamy music? You know, like, how important was it that you really... Because it hasn't ended up being a label like that at all. Like, it's a very diverse roster.
Yeah, I think that can only happen over time, because there are periods where people did think certain things about Bella Union and sort of made assumptions that, oh, it's just an Americana kind of label. You know, they've got the Zars, they've got Laura Veers, they've got Fleet Foxes, they've got Midlake, it's all folky. You know, there's moments in time where people have sort of made assumptions by a cluster of groups we may have signed that fitted into one particular box. But I guess I was always, maybe not self-conscious about it, but certainly conscious that, you know, you can't over 1 year tell the story of what your music taste is or what you're trying to bring and what you're curating. You know, unless you're able to release 12 albums, one a month, that are all just either totally the same or completely different, your story can't be told in that 1 year alone. So I've always sort of thought, it's probably going to take several years for people to have a true understanding, for me to even have a true understanding as to what this label could be. Because my tastes are always different. They're always expanding. I'm not somebody that just wants to sign the same band over and over again. There are lots of labels that do that very successfully, and hats off to them. But I love a lot of these labels. But since working in a record shop very early, my only job, apart from being in a band doing this, was in a record shop. So my taste went from being completely one-dimensional from sort of age 15 to sort of 20 to broadening out a little bit when I worked in a little indie record store, the Beggar's Banquet Shop, actually, was my first job, to working at Our Price in the early 80s, which is like a chain of, it was almost like your HMV of today, you know, where every band, every record released is in the store, when I suddenly learn a lot more about the music business, and not the music business, but the amount of music there is out there. And my taste therefore expanded. Going into my 30s, traveling around the world with the Cocteau Twins, going to see lots of other bands, meeting new people, and just that influence you have of friends and people around you. And I feel that my journey's still going on. I'm still learning about different areas of music, still falling in love with things. So if I can bring that to the table, which is what the label's really there for me to be self-indulgent enough to release things that I love, then that's great. That's all I'm really doing. I'm just being very selfish.
Yeah. No, well, I think all the best labels are in that respect, aren't they? You know, when I'd heard, I was a big fan, from sort of word go, really, of Big Joni. I remember when I put them, I was dropping them in Kerrang all the time during the kind of latter days of me working there, when I was starting to think I've just had enough of this place. And it's really amazing watching how it's grown since. But when I found out that you were managing them, I was like, oh, well, that's another thing he's now doing. I don't know, like, I'm not saying you're stretching yourself too thin, but, like, how did you come to that?
That was through my wife. You know, my wife and I have been co-managing a few bands for a couple of years. We started off, well, you know, I suppose the first band we did together was Penelope Isles, who we still work with today. Great friends of ours from here in Brighton, part of our family, very much so. So that was the first band we did together. And then Abby saw Big Joni at, that's my wife, Abby, she saw Big Joni at, was it Coachella? No, not Coachella, at Primavera, I think. Or no, maybe it wasn't Primavera. Well, it was somewhere.
Yeah.
Maybe a couple of years ago. And she came back and just said, we have to work with them. So I'm like, great, fantastic, played us the record, loved it. So we, you know, she was the one that brought that into the management company. We do Divide and Dissolve as well, which is a band on Invader Records, another thing that, you know, she brought in. So, you know, it's great for me to have this extra part of the Bella Union coming to the fore in the last couple of years, because I think management is, whilst the record business is sort of very broken right now, you know, it feels like maybe it's been broken for a long time, but it just feels a bit bust.
Yeah.
Like, you know, everything is like a mess. And record campaigns seem to just stutter and fall. There's not hardly anywhere to review records anymore. The press side of things is
just dead, really.
Desperate. It's like, you know, music magazines dropping dead, newspapers going from 4 reviews to 2 reviews. You know, whilst the online world is expanding and you think, well, why wouldn't The Guardian have 20 reviews online if they can only have 2 in the paper? Well, that's fair enough, but why can't they have 20 online? I don't know the answer. There aren't seem to be answers to these questions. So I'm finding the whole music business thing utterly confusing. So management, in a way, is quite it's a lot more stressful and frustrating in the sort of business sense. But in terms of helping and getting more involved with different aspects of an artist's career, it's very rewarding when it works. Like with Big Joni, you know, amazing people to work with. Absolutely the best. Penelope Isles, again, absolutely the very best people. Now, you're not always going to get that right. You're going to work with people that is just a pain in the ass, you know, and they don't get what you do and you don't get what they do. And it's a clash. That will happen eventually because you can't always have it your own way. But right now, our management roster is very pleasurable, very pleasurable.
Yeah, no, yes. It's weird, you know. I would have said at one point that, you know, sometimes difficult people are the most interesting people, but my wife works in management and she would probably argue completely against that. So
it can be a struggle.
Yeah, I can see the distinction. We were saying, you know, you were almost being quite restrained there, really, about like the music business. And for me, I think it's extraordinary, like the mess and disarray that it's in. But I also guess I kind of feel like weirdly excited about that because I think there's sort of opportunity within that, if that makes sense. And there was a lot about the music business which has been wrong for, you know, decades, generations.
That's it.
What would you do? What needs to be done? Like, how do we? I've asked that question to people before, but sometimes the answer has been like, I've got no idea. I'm terrified. This is crazy. I've never known anything like it. But do you have any ideas about what needs to be done?
Well, for us, that's such a big question in terms of like the business, because the business is so fractured and everyone's got their own little domain that they look over and look after. And you know, I'm not going to start making judgments about what other people do because it's not my place. In terms of my own place in the world and what I can do a lot more than the current independent music business structure allows me to do or is allowing me to do. I need to break out of it and just do what I want, because I think anarchy is really the best approach with the music business right now. Just scrap the rule book, throw it away. Because this model of 2 singles to radio, you know, and 7 weeks waiting around for radio to play it or not play it, or playlist or not play it, and then you can't go back to radio with a third track. With the way that media works, the way that press works, doing this sort of 3-month lead campaign with the magazines, everything is just all a bit arse over tit, because bands are not hanging around, sitting about waiting for a playlist on the radio or waiting for a review in The Guardian, because they most likely won't get one.
Yeah,
because there just aren't enough reviews to have.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think, you know, bands have just got to stop worrying about what the world thinks of them and just get on with the business of being a band. And I think the labels have got to do that and just try and fit around them. You know what I mean? It's like right now you put a record in production and then maybe a year later you get it out. But how does that make any sense? It's just ludicrous. If you think back to the 80s, when Cocteau Twins went in the studio, maybe 3 weeks, 4 weeks later, you could have a record in the shops, an EP or whatever.
Yeah.
Maybe 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Now it's pretty much a year from the time you deliver a record to when it can actually come out. What is the band supposed to do between now and then? Just sit around doing absolutely nothing. Write another record that they won't be able to play and put out until 2. You know, it's just all mad. So I'm thinking, like, okay, bands have just got to get a different approach. Don't worry about what your record label's going to do. Just do what you want to do. Put stuff up on Bandcamp. Find a place that will make 100 records rather than 1,000. Because no one's buying 1,000 vinyls of a new band. They're only really buying 100.
Yeah.
But most bands who are pressing their own records are having to press a minimum amount of 300, 400, 500 because the pressing plants don't really want to press 100. So that doesn't work either. So you've got all these things that, oh, that could work. Yeah, but it doesn't really work because then we're going to be left with 200, 300 records in our basement that are all going to go rotten after 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like I'm just trying to kind of get a grip on what I can do to help, which is work with a band, talk to them from the beginning, explain how shit everything is, and do we just go along with accepting that that's how shit everything is, or do we just go and do our own thing anyway? Just go on tour, put some records out, put some music up digitally. Don't wait for the record label to get their shit together. Get on with your business. Get on with your life. Make things happen. Don't just sit around waiting. And that's what I think we all need to do is take that kind of punk rock approach to the music business and scrap this whole structure, this strategy thing. Because for me, in 9 times out of 10, it's a load of nonsense.
I think that we weren't specifically talking about that, but I think that might be the moment that we put a full stop on this and I go write some of my book. I feel like that was actually the kick up the arse I might have indirectly needed. Listen, thanks so much for talking to me, man. Like I say, I'm so... your music's given me, you know, the music you've made and the music that the label has put out has given me so much in my life. So it's a real pleasure to do
this. Thank you, James. Thank you. I mean, I'm just stumbling my way through trying to make some sense of it all. You know, lucky enough, privileged enough to be able to put music out and for people like yourself to drop in when you can and listen and support it. And that's all we can hope to do. You know, my expectation levels are super low these days. Be quiet. Be quiet. What do you want? Annoying cat.
This is, oh, it's a cat now. I was going
to
say this.
I've got a dog and a cat. I think the cat wants to be... it's one of those cats that doesn't make any sense.
It does feel more of a dog podcast than a cat podcast. I've been invaded by dogs a few times now. So.
It's both.
Listen, let's do a part two in maybe like 25 years or something.
Yeah, I'll do it from my wheelchair.
We'll do it in space. Thanks so much, Simon.
Take care, mate. Good luck with your book.
Well, that was episode 114. Thanks to Simon for the chat. The theme tune is by the band Jobbers. And I'll see you soon.
He was like, don't give up. And I was just like, I never did.